This is a recording of the open meeting of the Federal Election Commission scheduled for June 22nd. Should you have questions after listening to this recording, please call the FEC at 800-424-9530 or email us at info@fec.gov.
Our first advisory opinion this morning is Draft Advisory Opinion 2006-17, brought by Berkeley Electric Co-op. And from the Council's office on this matter is Tony Buckley and Mai Din. And it is my understanding that this is Ms. Din's last executive session. Is she with us right now? There she is. Ms. Din's last last open session at the Federal Election Commission. She is moving on to another fine federal agency, but all my colleagues join me in congratulating you, Mai, and thanking you for your tremendous work these many years. Mai has been a key part of the policy team within the Office of General Counsel and played a key role in the many rulemakings we've done to implement the McCain-Feingold Law, as well as these advisory opinions that we've done. And you will be missed, and thank you for all of your work. And so from the Council's office on this advisory opinion, Tony Buckley. Mr. Buckley, good morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, Commissioners. The Berkeley Electric Cooperative Incorporated and its separate segregated fund, BEC PAC, requested the advisory opinion before you in Agenda Document 06-45. The request asks whether Berkeley may solicit its executive and administrative personnel and employees who are members of the cooperative for contributions to BEC PAC and for contributions to the Action Committee for Rural Electrification, or ACRE, the separate segregated fund of the National Rural Electric Cooperative Association, as well as two organizations involved in state and local activity. The request also asks whether Berkeley may use a proposed form to solicit the contributions and whether it may use payroll deductions to collect them. The draft concludes that Berkeley may solicit its executive administrative personnel and its members, including members who are employed by Berkeley, for contributions to BEC PAC because Berkeley is an incorporated membership organization and these persons are within its solicitable class. The draft further concludes that Berkeley may solicit its executive and administrative personnel and its members, including members who are employed by Berkeley, for contributions to ACRE because Berkeley is considered a local unit of the NRECA and therefore may act as a collecting agent for NRECA's separate segregated fund, ACRE. As a collecting agent, Berkeley may solicit its solicitable class. The draft also concludes that Berkeley may use its proposed form to solicit contributions for BEC PAC and ACRE. However, the draft advises Berkeley to modify the form to clarify that it is only soliciting contributions from its solicitable class. In addition, the draft approves the use of payroll deductions to collect contributions for BEC PAC and ACRE. The draft expresses no opinion regarding Berkeley's proposed solicitation of contributions for the two organizations involved in state and local activity because those questions are outside of the Commission's jurisdiction. Thank you, and I'd be happy to address any questions you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Buckley. Discussion of the draft before us? Commissioner Mason.
I'm not sure whether I might have a conflict on this, and I want to explain. You may not realize it, but the Berkeley Electric Co-op is headquartered in Monk's Corner, South Carolina. And in the 1930s, Monk's Corner was kind of the Las Vegas of South Carolina. I know there were only about 6,000 people in the town, but the state code at the time provided that if you weren't being married in a church, you had to be married by a clerk of court. And the clerk of courts in most of the 46 counties in South Carolina thought you really ought to be married in church. And so if you showed up, they had some questions about why and the family and so on like that. And my grandparents, who were not residents of Berkeley County, apparently were unsatisfied with their options in their home county and traveled to Monk's Corner, where the clerk had a rather broader view. Apparently he felt like if you were of age and had the fee, that he would perform his statutory obligations. And I rather suspect the clerk was a member of the Berkeley Electric Co-op. And but for his actions, I wouldn't be here. So I just wanted to provide that little bit of history.
We could drop a footnote, perhaps. We've been known to do that from time to time. Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, in my many years as an ethics counselor, nobody has ever come up with such an obscure reason for a recusal. I'm not your lawyer, but I think you can probably vote on this, Commissioner.
Do we have a motion? Commissioner Mason.
On counsel's advice, I would move approval of the draft advisory.
Commissioner Mason has moved approval of agenda document number 0645 for draft advisory opinion 2006-17. Discussion on Commissioner Mason's motion. Hearing none, I'll call the question. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries by a vote of 5-0 with Commissioner Walther absent. Thank you, Mr. Buckley. Our next item of business this morning is draft advisory opinion 2006-18, sought by Representative Kay Granger. And we have a late-submitted document submitted by Commissioner Weintraub. Mr. Vice Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to move for the suspension of the rules for the timely submission of documents to consider agenda document 06-46A.
Vice Chairman is so moved. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Motion carries by a vote of all five commissioners present. And from the counsel's office on this matter, Mr. Dwayne Pugh.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and good morning. Agenda document number 06-46 presents the commission with a draft advisory opinion that responds to a request by Representative Granger and the K. Granger Campaign Fund. The request asks whether the committee may use paid personnel, its website, and its mailing list of email addresses to promote sales of a children's book written by Representative Granger. Because Representative Granger's royalties will be donated to charitable organizations, she will not personally gain from the use of committee funds or assets for the contemplated activities. Therefore, the draft advisory opinion states that the proposed activities would not constitute a prohibited personal use of campaign funds. The draft concludes that the committee may use its website, its mailing list, and its paid personnel to promote sales of Representative Granger's book and to organize, attend, and promote book-related events. Thank you.
Thank you. And Commissioner Weintraub, you had offered a document. Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, I had a few small amendments. I thought the footnotes in the draft were a little bit confusing and didn't really add much to the substance. So I'm proposing to delete the current footnotes, but to add a new one that would just make explicit what I think is already implicit in the document, which is that to the extent that Representative Granger would take a tax deduction, it would merely be to offset the income that she has to declare from the royalties, and that at the end of the day, it's net zero for her. She doesn't realize any income. And I think that was already implicit in the draft, and it was represented, I believe, by counsel in the request, but I just wanted to make it very clear because I think that is the really the key point here, that she's not going to recognize any personal financial benefit. That's what distinguishes this case, in my mind, from the Hayworth case, the Hayworth AO that I didn't vote for. Since we're in historical mode, the personal use restrictions are of long standing, and in the old days, back in when I was a mere child, the members could actually put the money in their pockets after they left Congress. They just got to whatever was left in the bank, they could just transfer into their own bank account and walk off with it. And back around 1980, Congress finally got around to saying, well, maybe that doesn't look so good, but in order to get the votes to abolish that practice, they had to put in a grandfather clause such that everybody who was currently in Congress could still do it, but anybody who got elected the following year, they couldn't walk off with the money. And it took them about another 10 years until the Ethics Reform Act of 89 before they were willing to say, well, okay, you got one last chance. If you retire now at the end of this Congress, you can still walk off with the money, but after this Congress, anybody who's in Congress, they can't keep the money anymore.
Were there a number of retirements as a result of that?
I think there were a few retirements that year, but there are always a few retirements, and then there were some who thought that they maybe should have retired in retrospect, but that's another story altogether. But I think that history shows that what these personal use restrictions were designed to prevent was something very tangible and direct, a very tangible and direct benefit to the member that they couldn't pocket their campaign funds for a variety of very good reasons. And that's why the fact that this member, like many members before her, has set up her contract with her publisher such that, as I understand it, the money doesn't even go through her bank account. It goes directly from the publisher straight to the C3 organizations. But under the tax code, since she is causing that to happen. She still has to declare that income, and that's why she wants to take the tax deduction, but as I said, it just leaves her at a net zero. I do want to point out one other fact about this that is significant to me, although it's not specifically discussed in the opinion, and that is that she's written a children's book. I haven't read the book. I'm sure it's a fine book, but it talks about public values and civic virtues, and I think that the argument could certainly be made that it is related to her duties as an office holder and as a public figure to be promoting civic education and civic values in young people. If it were a book of fairy tales, if it were a book of restaurant reviews or something that was completely unrelated to her status as a member, that might give me pause. Those facts aren't in front of us today. It's not, but since I wanted to just raise that, since it's not actually written into the opinion, that is a factor for me. Don't have to think about what I might do in those circumstances. I just wanted to say that it is important to me and makes it an easier case for me. It would be really easy if it was a policy book and she was using it to enhance her stature in the world at large as a deep thinker in the party, but I think even in this case it's related to her duties. She's not realizing any benefits. So with the amendments that I've offered, I'd be prepared to support the draft.
Thank you, Commissioner Weintraub. Never too early to go after the younger voters in the electorate. Discussion on the documents before us? Vice Chairman Linhart.
I guess it's with some trepidation that I take a different position from Commissioner Weintraub on an issue that relates to personal use and ethics, because I think she has an enormous amount of experience in wrestling through those issues. That said, as I look at the statute itself that we're interpreting here, it strikes me that there are two components that we need to consider. The first is whether the expense would exist irrespective of the candidate's election campaign, and the conclusion here is that it would not have existed. That would have existed irrespective of the campaign. It was not campaign related. As Commissioner Weintraub has indicated, there's some questions where that could be a close call, where the book clearly could be a direct component of the campaign, but the analysis here takes it that it is not related. The second part of the statutory test deals with whether it is fulfilling any commitment, obligation, or expense of the candidate. And my sense is that the analysis here has moved to a point where it really is equating that with whether the candidate derives income from the activity, and it's not clear to me that that's really the statutory limit. I'm struck in this case that the expenditures themselves that are going to be conducted involves the use of staff time and more than a de minimis amount of staff time to organize book events, to go to the sites, to prepare materials for the events, and to, in essence, operate a book tour. This, in some ways, does seem to be to my eyes, to be an obligation or expense that the candidate would bear, but for the fact that the campaign is paying for it. While again, I go back to where I began, which is I approach with some trepidation, not following the analysis of Commissioner Weintraub, given her experience. My sense is that the statute is drafted somewhat more broadly, and would capture this kind of activity.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chairman. Additional discussion on the issues? Do we have a motion, Commissioner Mason, or Commissioner Von Spakovsky?
I'd move approval of draft advisory opinion 2006-18 with the amendments set forth in agenda document 0646A.
Commissioner Mason has moved approval of agenda document number 0646 in draft advisory opinion 2006-18 as amended by Commissioner Weintraub's document at agenda document number 0646A. Discussion on Commissioner Mason's motion. I'll call the question. All those in favor say aye. Aye. All opposed?
No.
Motion carries by a vote of 4-1, with the Vice Chairman dissenting and Commissioner Walther absent. Thank you.
Thank you.
Our next item of business this morning is Draft Advisor Opinion 2006-10, sought by EchoStar Satellite LLC. And we have Robert Knopf from the Council's office and the ever-present Mai Din as well. Mr. Knopf.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We have an advisory opinion request from EchoStar Satellite LLC. EchoStar is a pay television satellite service that wishes to air a series of public service announcements featuring prominent Americans, including members of Congress. These PSAs would promote and solicit donations for charitable causes, such as aid to victims of Hurricane Katrina, or awareness of public health issues, such as breast cancer. The PSAs would not contain campaign materials or expressly advocate the election or defeat of a clearly identified candidate. Nor would they refer to any political party, election, or campaign, or solicit any contributions for a political campaign or political committee. They also would not be aired in the featured candidates' jurisdictions during the relevant electioneering communications windows. EchoStar asks whether its proposed PSAs would constitute coordinated communications. The draft before you concludes that they would be exempt from the definition of coordinated communications, provided that certain requirements are met. Specifically, because the proposed PSAs would not promote, support, attack, or oppose the federal candidates featured in the communications, the draft concludes that the proposed PSAs would qualify for the charitable solicitation exception, provided that the organizations for which the funds are solicited are 501c organizations, and provided the solicitations themselves comply with the requirements of the general solicitation provision in section 300.65 of the Commission's regulations. Thank you, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Knopf. Discussion? I'll just have a couple quick comments at the outset. I intend to support the draft that we have before us. I think it is a proper reading of the solicitation safe harbor that Mr. Knopf was outlining. But I also thought it was important that the draft confirm that there are other avenues through which this activity can take place, namely that under our recently revised coordination rules, communications that don't contain express advocacy and do not republish campaign materials but that air more than 90 days before an election when a congressional candidate is depicted is another avenue for this type of activity, and the draft indicates that. And also, when you have a public communication that depicts a federal candidate or office holder but does not run in the district or state in which that candidate is up for election, that's another avenue by which this activity can take place. So I thought it was important not to create the impression that the only way this activity can proceed is through the solicitation safe harbor, that there were other avenues under the new coordination rules under which it could take place. But I also think the flip side is true, that the agencies essentially occupied the field in terms of trying to flesh out what types of communications are for the purpose of influencing a federal election. And so if the various rules come into play and you satisfy the content prong and the conduct prong and the payment prong, then the agency, I think, appropriately can treat that type of communication as for the purpose of influencing a federal election, therefore as an in-kind contribution under the appropriate circumstances. So I thought it was important to also say that. But I think overall the opinion is a solid, balanced approach in terms of trying to answer the question. I anticipate there will be a number of additional advisory opinions seeking to flesh out our new coordination rules, but I thought the draft before us was a solid effort in that regard. Discussion. Vice Chairman Linhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This advisory opinion presents itself to us as a consequence of a somewhat awkward procedural posture, in the sense that it was originally submitted to us prior to the adoption of our coordination regs, and then amended after them to adjust itself according to the new regulations and to try and conform. The consequence of that, however, is that we are a little left a little vague as to the substance of what these ads are going to look like. They have they've given us a single script, which isn't exactly how the ads will read now, given the changes to the regs. And they have made a number of representations of what the ads will look like. Among those, as is noted in the staff draft, is that they will not contain campaign materials, will not expressly advocate the election or defeat of candidates. They're not going to refer to political parties, elections, or campaigns, and they're not going to solicit contributions for political campaigns and political committees. They also make representations that the ads will not include campaign issues as topics of the ads, and that they will not make reference to pending official matters. We don't have a complete script of any ads, and we have a partial script of only one ad that covers only one of the topics that they describe themselves as interested in pursuing. And yet, despite the limited factual record, the staff draft concludes that these ads do not promote, attack, support, or oppose the candidates that are going to appear in them. My sense is that while I am made cautious by the absence of scripts for all the ads, that the representations the candidates that the requesters have made as to what the PSAs will contain leads me with some level of comfort that they are permissible under the regs. However, in reaching that conclusion, I find it essential that they identify that they're not going to be raising campaign issues or discussing pending official matters. And the reason why that's important to me is because as I begin to think through what kind of lessons I could draw as a political actor out there from this advisory opinion, I began to think through the different kinds of ads that might contain campaign issues and discuss pending official matters, although they otherwise would fit our regulatory regime. And it struck me as reasonably easy to construct ads that did paso candidates once I began ignoring those factors, once I began adding campaign issues and pending official matters. And it made these PSAs begin to drift much closer to the issues related to grassroots lobbying. That strikes me as a matter formally a matter that people have asked us for rulemaking on, and involves a myriad of sort of interesting and competing concerns. And so, to my mind, the request as presented to us seemed to be to avoid the PASO test to be a permissible request for PSAs. But that the staff drafts not adding the requester's representations about campaign issues and pending official matters was important and shifted what I thought of the staff drafts, my willingness to support the staff's draft. So I wanted to raise that issue. I realize that we are dealing with an advisory opinion. My sense is, to the degree that we can answer, to the degree that a requester presents a narrow issue that is easy to resolve, we should provide them guidance. My concern is, to the degree that we move away from the narrow request and end up with broader issues that raise other issues, more complex issues with somewhat different fact patterns. Either those need to be sorted out, or that I can't support the approach presented. So, I wanted to raise that issue. Depending upon folks' feelings about it, move for the inclusion of language in the staff draft that references the requester's identification that they will not be touching on those issues.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chairman. Discussion of the issues before us. Didn't take long for our coordination rules to be on the books, and as the Vice Chairman correctly noted, even before they were on the books, we had this advisory opinion. Discussion of the issues. Commissioner Von Sikorski.
Well, in 6 months, I've learned to have great respect for the Vice Chairman's legal opinions, but I do have to differ with him on this, with all due respect. I support the draft that OGC has prepared as it's written, and I am going to oppose inclusion of this other language because the Vice Chairman wants to include language
on campaign issues not being part of the PSA. Well, the problem with that is we don't have a legal term for campaign issues in our regulations or in the statute. And I don't know, have no idea how in the world we would enforce that. If somebody does a PSA saying the Red Cross is a great organization, they did terrific work during and in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, please support the Red Cross. Well, I think Hurricane Katrina has been a pretty hot issue in Washington, if I read the news and watch the news too. And you could very easily say, well, they've just violated the law because Katrina was a campaign issue. I in fact think we ought to go further here because there's this very odd hole in our regulations. You know, we've just issued a coordination rule where we're saying that if a federal candidate, for example, endorses a state candidate, but in no way promotes his own campaign or anything like that, that's okay. We have a solicitation exemption here, which is the one we're taking advantage of, that says that if a federal candidate solicits funds for a charitable organization and is not promoting his candidacy, that's okay. But we don't have an exemption for the same candidate endorsing the charitable organization, which I think is very odd. In other words, it's okay for the candidate to say, the Red Cross is a great organization, and I think you should send them funds, and that fits within our exemption. But if the candidate says simply, the Red Cross is a great organization, you should support them, it doesn't fit within our exemption, which to me is very odd. I mean, I think we should go further than this, but I understand limiting our answer to what's been presented to us, and I would, after discussion is over, be happy to move that we approve this as drafted by the OGC. Mr. Chairman, thank you.
Thank you. Vice Chairman Linhart.
Thank you. And again, I appreciate Commissioner Von Spakovsky's thoughts. I think that he always brings, important, issues and reflections to these discussions. In response to the specific question of what is a campaign issue, I guess I go back to the question of what are we trying to determine. And here we're trying to determine whether the PSAs will promote or support a candidate or who is also an office holder in this particular setting. And to the degree that the PSA is drawing on or is about the campaign issues, it strikes me as dramatically more likely that it ends up promoting the campaign. And to the degree that the requester has indicated that they will not do it, it makes it dramatically more likely that it does not promote or support the candidate's campaign, especially in the context of an AO where we have no text.
Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think both of my colleagues make some very fine points. My philosophy of long standing on AOs is that we should answer them in the narrowest way possible. Somebody asks us a nice narrow question, we should give them a nice narrow answer. And the requester has very conveniently and kindly made this a nice narrow, very easy question, I think. I think if we were to add language saying, just repeating the language from the request, you said you're not going to have any campaign issues in here. That's just a true statement. They said they're not going to have any campaign issues. That makes it really easy. You know, we don't have to think about, actually, the issue that we're talking about right now, which is what would we do if somebody then came in a later request and said, well, gee, we've got a PSA that we want to participate in, but it does raise an issue that is an issue in the campaign. Are we still allowed to do that? That's another question that we don't have to answer today. And I'm perfectly happy to answer the very narrow, delightful, easy question that we've been asked today, and you know, save the more difficult question, and that I don't think we have any disagreement on. I think it would be unfortunate if we couldn't answer the question that's in front of us that we actually, I think, all agree on the answer to, because we are trying to make a point about the next request that comes down the road that is in front of us. You know, let's save that disagreement for another day when we actually have to confront it. And I'm supportive of adding the language to that the vice chairman wants to add, because I think it's already inherent as I added language in the previous AO that I thought was already inherent in the request that Representative Granger wasn't going to realize any economic benefit, here again, I think what the Vice Chairman is suggesting, that we just add language that makes it obvious what was in the request. This is the AO, by its nature, is only answering the question that was asked. That was part of the question that was asked, and I think that's the question that we ought to answer, particularly because it's one that we don't disagree on. So I would urge my colleagues to look at it as not... not really expanding or narrowing the scope of the AO at all, but merely just adding in more information about what was in the request for the ease of people that will be reading it, so they don't have to go back and reread the entire request. They can just read the AO and see, you know, there's a good, solid summary of what was asked for.
Well, we always aim to please and accommodate our readers at the Federal Election Commission. A couple points. I think both the Vice Chairman, Commissioner Weintraub, and Commissioner Von Spakovsky raise important issues. For me, the biggest question on the Vice Chairman's language is, I'm not sure I understand how the presence or absence of campaign issues or pending official matters is relevant for those communications that don't contain express advocacy and don't republish campaign materials, which the requester has stipulated they're not doing, that air more than 90 days before an election, or that air in places outside of the state or jurisdiction in which the congressional canon is identified. As I understand our coordination regulations, in those circumstances, the content of the communication is irrelevant. And so whether there's whatever we would regard as campaign issues or whatever we would regard as references to pending official matters, the legality of the communication would not turn on the presence or absence of those elements. So that's my first question, because I think the language on pages 5 to 6 of the draft makes clear that there is the ability for these PSAs to proceed as a matter of law when they air more than 90 days before the election or when they're not targeted to the relevant electorate. So that's sort of my first take on that, and I'd be interested in thoughts on that. Vice Chairman Linhart.
I guess I go back to my earlier point, which is that these ads are permissible only to the degree that they fit within the exception, and one of the conditions of fitting within the exception is that they not promote, attack, support, or oppose the person appearing in the ad to the degree that they're a candidate. It strikes me that the fact that these ads are not discussing any issues in the campaign makes it much easier to discern that they will not promote the candidate.
I guess my take is somewhat different, because I don't think the ads are permissible only if they fall within the solicitation exemption. I agree that that is one way in which they're permissible, but I also think they're permissible if they air more than 90 days before the election and don't contain express advocacy or republication of campaign materials. And that, in my reading of the regs, that's permissible regardless of whether there's a solicitation element or regardless of the safe harbor that we existed. And I also think they're permissible if they don't contain express advocacy and republish campaign materials and are not run in the relevant jurisdiction of the candidates. So my sense is that there are other avenues in which the activity is permissible, separate and apart from the solicitation safe harbor. Although I agree that the solicitation safe harbor, a key element to satisfying that is the absence of PASO. I think that's absolutely right. But does that make sense that there are these, if these other avenues exist independently, I wouldn't want to suggest that they're foreclosed.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the problem that I'm wrestling with is to the degree that our coordination regulations prohibit these activities but for the presence of the exemption for solicitations for charities, then this issue is important.
Right, and I think my reading of the regs, though, is that if the ad runs more than 90 days before the election and doesn't contain express advocacy or republished campaign materials, it doesn't meet the content prong, even if we never had a solicitation exemption. So that would dispose of it. We wouldn't have to reach the solicitation issue in that circumstance. And likewise, if the ads are not targeted to the relevant electorate, it doesn't meet the content prong and therefore is permissible, again, without regard to the solicitation safe harbor. That's all.
But I didn't think the requester had indicated the ads weren't going to run within those time periods.
My understanding is that the requester didn't make any representations about time periods other than they would not be an electioneering communication, but otherwise didn't say when they were going to be running them. And so I thought it was important that the draft indicate, okay, if you're going to run them more than 90 days before an election, great, that's an avenue that's available. Or if you're not going to target them to the relevant electorate, that's another avenue. But that the requester had not specified exactly when they were going to run them.
Yeah, I had taken it that the requester was willing and interested in running the permissibility of running these ads up until the electioneering communication window.
My sense is that they had maybe a plan to run some early in the cycle before 90 days, maybe some later. But I guess my major point is that, for me, the ability to run them outside of 90 days, earlier than 90 days, and when they're not targeted to the electorate, is a separate independent avenue for the activity to proceed, regardless of the presence or absence of PASO and regardless of the solicitation exemption. Commissioner Mason.
First, I just wanted to raise a separate issue momentarily. It's a little like one of the things Commissioner Weintraub brought up before. I had raised with the staff and the emails back and forth the media exemption, and it doesn't look – I don't see immediately that there was something in there. So, Mr. Knopp, correct me if I'm wrong. Is there a reference to that? Okay, so I've missed it. All right, good. All right, thank you. I just wanted to note my view on that if it wasn't, but the point being that since we're dealing with a media corporation, we can probably deal with this on the grounds that are here, but if for some reason we couldn't, there are those media exemptions out there that might otherwise come into play. So on the campaign issue question, I very much agree with the chairman about the different bases that might be here. But I'm also concerned about simply taking language from a submission that somehow may suggest something that we're talking about ease of readers that I can't explain. For instance, there's no reference in our regulations to well, I guess there is in terms of reference to political parties, but repeating the language that the requester puts here about references to elections or campaigns, I think is fairly clear. In other words, that's an objective standard. Everybody is going to look at it, understand what it means. There could be a factual question about whether something is or isn't an election, a reference to an election, and we could deal with that. And so I don't mind putting that language in there, even though it isn't precisely out of the regulations, because I think it's helpful. The trouble I have with campaign issues is that I don't know how to render that, and in part for the reason Commissioner Von Spakovsky brought up. Campaign issue could be Hurricane Katrina, and so then the question could arise, well, is an appeal for Katrina relief a campaign issue? Is it a campaign issue in general? Is it a campaign issue for that particular candidate because they're from the Gulf Coast? And I don't know the answer. I raised with my colleagues the question of education. And a lot of times education's a campaign issue, No Child Left Behind and so on like that. Does that mean that a solicitation on behalf of an organization that's providing scholarship funds for needy students would be bearing on a campaign issue? I'm not sure about that. The exhibit that's here is heart disease and heart disease awareness among women in particular, and we know that the National Institutes for Health has various programs involved with disease awareness for various groups and so on like that, and that the budget and earmarks for particular programs come up in Congress. I remember Phil Schalero, who Commissioner Weintraub knows, made a big issue of some cancer-related legislation that he was a House staffer running for Congress, got his then boss to introduce a piece of legislation and tried to make that a platform in his campaign for Congress. And so while we might well look at it and say, well, gee, this is something we don't want to encourage, the trouble I have is that I'm not sure what campaign issue means or how we would construe it or render it. And particularly as to coordination, that's not a topic or a standard that we chose. At one time, the commission did use campaign issues as a basis for its coordination analysis. It wasn't written in the reg, but it was in, if you look at the cases, that comes up, and it was the basis of our filing a lawsuit against Forbes magazine, because Forbes magazine had editorials and news stories on campaign issues that Steve Forbes pursued in the in the presidential campaign. And in that case, it was pretty obvious. It was a flat tax. I mean, it wasn't something sort of tricky that, that people couldn't figure out whether it was campaign issues. So because we haven't used that standard in our regulation, I don't think we ought to introduce it in interpreting an exemption to the regulation, because essentially we'd be building it back in, and also because I think it would essentially be misleading to people if we want to try to be helpful for them to think about it, because all of a sudden then our outside counsel will be racking their brains to figure out, okay, well, what is this campaign issue and what does that mean? So while I'm, you know, it's in the submission, because I don't understand what the ramifications or extent or what limitations would be implied by it, I think it's actually rather unhelpful to put it out there, simply because I think it doesn't help clarify what we're trying to do.
Vice Chairman Lenhardt.
Thank you. My sense is that yes, that there are circumstances where a Katrina could be the central issue in a campaign, and that ads that talk in which a candidate appears talking about Katrina could promote that candidate's campaign, depending upon how the ad is phrased and the context in which it occurs. I think that that can happen. And put differently, I think to say that we are interpreting this rule to say that could never occur, and that regardless of the content, regardless of its role in the election, regardless of how the ad is phrased or the issues are presented, we are not, we would not, the fact that it is a quote-unquote PSA would allow it to fall within the exemption so long as it didn't contain express advocacy of the other issues raised here. So I think that the answer is yes, while we may struggle with what precisely a campaign issue might be in all of the different facts and which might go into that. Similarly, we can argue about what is a PSA, what does it mean for something to be a PSA, and does the way the ad is phrased shift or change it. I think that for me, the requester has made the problem reasonably simple. They have said that they will not, include among the contents of these ads things that they consider to be campaign issues, and to the degree that they have said that, that gives me some comfort that these ads are not going to promote or support a candidate, though I have none of the texts of the ads before me. And the notion that they simply, address an issue like Katrina, which is politically charged and may, in fact, be a dispositive issue in elections in Louisiana, is not enough.
If I could, Mr. Vice Chairman, are you referring to the language at the bottom of page 1 of the advisory opinion request? And I'm just at the bottom of that paragraph. It says, they say a sample script is attached as Exhibit A, and then it goes on and it says, regardless of whether or not a particular PSA features a member of Congress, the PSAs will not make reference to any pending official matter. And then it says they will also not contain campaign materials or express advocacy. Is that what you're...
It appears in two places, these references. That is not the specific reference I was making,
okay.
Although when I talked earlier, when I first began talking, probably far too long ago, I mentioned sort of pending official matters and topics or issues that were in campaigns, and that reference appears on page 6 in the last full paragraph as they're describing the restrictions or limitations. Towards the bottom of that, they say, and I quote, no campaign issues will be permitted as topics for any of the PSAs, period. And then they go on to say, based upon these restrictions. So given that they made that affirmative representation, it afforded me the comfort to say that these, in fact, were not promoting the campaigns of the individuals that were appearing in the ads.
Thank you. Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to stress that this is an AO, it's not a regulation. So, you know, we don't have to explore all the parameters and all of the ramifications and, you know, what people will do in other circumstances based on this. We only have to answer this particular unique question. And we always have boilerplate language at the end of all of our AOs saying that, you know, if you differ in any material respect from the facts set forth in this AO, then, you know, you shouldn't assume that just because we said yes to these guys, we're going to say yes to you. We would not be, what the vice chairman is proposing would not be to say the only circumstances in which we think it is permissible to do this is if you agree to this same restriction that you're not going to raise any campaign issues. But the fact that they have made that representation is relevant to at least some of us. It may not be relevant to all of us, but it's relevant to some of us. It doesn't mean those are the only circumstances in which we would ever consider it, but it makes it just an easier question. We don't have to define all the terms in our AOs. As I said, it's an AO. It's not a regulation. We're taking them at their word. They say they won't use reference campaign issues, and they're going to be working with politicians, and I think we're sort of assuming that the politicians will know when they appear in these PSAs whether they're referencing campaign issues or not. And, you know, we figure they can work that out. We're not defining that term for them. It's not, including the language, is not a restriction on other activities necessarily. It just means that this is what they've said. That makes it an easier question for at least two of us. And as I said before, I think it would be kind of silly if we said, well, we can't answer the easy question because we disagree about a more complicated one that you haven't asked.
Well, I don't think any of us want to be silly. Commissioner Mace.
I shouldn't have used that word.
No problem. Part of this has to do with history, and it may not be a live threat with the six commissioners who currently sit in the council's office that's here, but most of you will remember the electioneering communication was had a long and controversial history at the agency. And the term electioneering communication appeared in, I believe, it was either a footnote, electioneering message, which is not the same as the statutory standard of electioneering communication now, appeared in an advisory opinion, either in a footnote or in a text that was characterizing a prior advisory opinion, which had not itself used that term. Just as some kind of a shorthand reference. And out of that grew this huge superstructure of enforcement doctrine. And I've seen other less dramatic examples where, an advisory opinion was acted on in part because of the requester's submission, and some of the media, some of the debate cases where people would come in and they would essentially lay out their debate format were used wrongly, in my view, this way. What would happen is people would say, we're going to do the following things, and they'd sort of lay out their debate rules, and some of the opinions reiterated the debate rules. And then later, when we had a debate, we'd look at the advisory opinion and say, oh, well, they didn't do that. They didn't do number 8, and therefore it falls out. And, of course, the question wasn't whether they did number 8, but whether the other 7 things they did complied, you know, with our rules or not. But that, in part, is at the root of my reluctance to throw in something which isn't in the regs and which, you know, I don't clearly understand. In other words, when you say, well, they've asserted this, I understand, and I think I could render, if they say, we're not going to refer to election. I think, you know, if we then get something back and somebody claims the protection of this, then I don't think I have a problem. But if somebody comes back and says there wasn't a campaign topic, I'm just not sure, and I'm not comfortable with saying, well, the members will know because other people raise campaign issues. I mean, there are groups assiduously going out and working to make immigration a campaign issue, and a lot of candidates would just as soon not talk about it. There are people on both sides, and it's uncomfortable. you know. That probably wouldn't be a topic of these PSAs, but the point is the candidates are
particularly
not.
They don't want to talk about it.
the candidates are not necessarily the people to determine campaign issues. Now, I very much agree with the vice chairman that as a factual matter, when these come up, we would have to make some renderings about whether a particular ad promoted, supported, attacked, or opposed. That's in the regulation. And I think as a factual matter, if there's a hot issue in a particular campaign there's a communication about that issue that bears on one or another of the candidates and their position on it, that yes, we could well look at that and say, in that context, this particular communication does promote, support, attack, or oppose the candidate. And if we say that, great. But I'm bothered by this campaign issue, rather broad and undefined arena as being some kind of a threshold that I don't see, you know, based anywhere in the regulations, and that I just don't understand where the rendering would go.
Mr. Vice Chairman.
Yeah, I've thought at this point what I would like to do is to make a motion to amend the staff draft, if we could. I would move that on page 2, line 13, that we add the language. This is, again, in the section where they're describing what the representations, add the language, moreover, no campaign issue will be permitted as topics for any of the PSAs, and the PSAs will not make reference to any pending official matter.
Thank you. That's the same here, you know. I'll just, okay. The Vice Chairman has moved approval of Agenda Document Number 0647 in Advisory Opinion 2006-10 with one amendment to page 2, line 13 of our agenda document, inserting the following sentence at that place: moreover, no campaign issues will be permitted as topics for any of the PSAs, and the PSAs will not make reference to any pending official matter, end quote. Discussion on Vice Chairman Lenhardt's motion to adopt.
I actually have a question.
Commissioner Von Spakovsky.
I want to be sure I understand this, because I thought, Mr. Vice Chairman, your motion was to amend the document, not actually adopt the entire document with the amended language, which is a different matter than simply now voting on whether to amend the OGC document. Could I get a clarification?
Mr. Vice Chairman, I guess we could go either way. It's either a motion to adopt or a motion to amend, and then we'd have a second motion. Whatever your pleasure.
I would vote to, you know, were this language to be added, I would vote to adopt the staff draft, period. So I'm comfortable with the chairman's phrasing. If as a procedural matter you'd like to handle it differently, I'd be willing to accommodate those concerns, but I'm comfortable with approving the staff draft as it exists if this sentence were to be added.
Commissioner Von Sikorski.
If you're comfortable doing it so that we do it in two steps, I'd request that you consider that, because I think I would hate to, as Commissioner Weintraub said earlier, for us to fail to put it on advisory opinion because of, I think we generally agree here on the general answer, and what we're arguing about is some finessing of the language, and I would hate to have us not put out an opinion because of a disagreement over that. So if it's okay with you, and I'd request that we do it in two steps. First, vote on whether to amend. Depending on how that goes, then vote on the OGC draft.
That's fine, although my sense was that were this motion to fail, then somebody could move the staff draft without the language, and so this would not be the end of the matter.
We can have as many motions as people would like to entertain here. Why don't we start on a motion to adopt your language?
Okay.
And then we'll see how that plays out, and if another motion's in order, we can do that.
I'm completely comfortable with that, so I would request that you amend the motion accordingly.
Okay. The Vice Chairman has moved to amend the staff draft, document number 06-47, by inserting at page 2, line 13, the staff draft, the sentence, moreover, no campaign issues will be permitted as topics for any of the PSAs, and the PSAs will not make reference to any pending official matter, end quote. Discussion on the vice chairman's motion. Commissioner Mason.
I'm just trying to understand where we're going to go. I'm not for this. And if it goes down, then what's going to happen?
And then we might have on the floor a motion to adopt the staff draft as is. And then we see how that goes.
All right.
And then who knows? Discussion on the vice chairman's motion to amend. Hearing none, I'll call the question. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed?
Nay.
No. Motion fails by a vote of 2-3. The vice chairman, Commissioner Weintraub, voting affirmatively. Commissioners Toner, Mason, and Von Spakovsky voting no. As I understand it then, a motion is in order on the staff draft. Yes, Commissioner Weintraub.
I'd just like to ask whether it might change any of the no's to yeses if we added, you have represented that. Would that make anybody feel better? Not seeing on any.
Seeing no takers.
Seeing no takers. All right, I won't bother to make the motion.
It's always good, though, to try to see if people could feel better. I like that. I'm with you on that. That makes sense.
Just a thought.
Commissioner Weintraub, please.
Assuming that that would fail, could I suggest a 5-minute recess?
Recesses are always in order. We'll take a 5-minute recess and reconvene at that time. Why don't we resume? I can't help myself, but Ms. Din, I'm sure you're thinking your decision to leave the Federal Election Commission will be better and better every moment this discussion unfolds. Do we have additional motions for consideration? Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm going to offer what I think is a very reasonable compromise with absolutely no hope that it will actually win, but I'm going to offer it anyway because I like it. Mr. Vice Chairman, if I might borrow your language.
Whichever. Oh, mine?
Yes.
Sure.
I would like to move that we approve the document, the draft advisory opinion 2006-10, with the following amendment on page 2, line 13, add, moreover, you have represented that no campaign issues will be permitted as topics for any of the PSAs, and the PSAs will not make reference to any pending official matter, with a footnote that would say, not all commissioners agree that this factor is relevant.
Let me try to get this down. Let me repeat it to make sure I have it down. Commissioner Weintraub is moving to amend the staff draft before us in AO 2006-10 by adding the following language on page 2, line 13 of the draft. Moreover, you have represented that no campaign issues will be permitted as topics for any of the PSAs, and the PSAs will not make reference to any pending official matter, end quote, and then drop a note, a footnote at that juncture that reads, not all commissioners agree that this factor is relevant. Discussion on Commissioner Weintraub's motion to amend. Commissioner Von Spakovsky.
Well, I'm going to oppose this because my understanding of the procedure here for many years has been that the advisory opinions reflect, if not the consensus, then at least 4 votes of the commissioners. And commissioners who dissent or have other views, write concurring opinions or they write a dissenting opinion. And I don't think we should have in the main body of the advisory opinion something on which there's not consensus like this, and that's, I think, essentially what you're doing when you say, when you want to put this in, but drop a footnote saying that, not all the commissioners agree to this. I mean, my suggestion, if you feel very strongly about this, is to, because again, it seemed like we agreed on the underlying issue here that, you write a concurring or slightly dissenting opinion, which, as the Supreme Court argues, concur but dissent in part, that lays out this issue as it's important to you and the Vice Chairman.
Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If I write a dissenting opinion, then we have no opinion to which to dissent because there won't be 4 votes. If I write a concurring opinion, it does not have the force of law. And as to your basic point that, we shouldn't put in something that everybody doesn't 100% agree with. There should be no language in here that everyone doesn't 100% agree with. I don't think that this is unprecedented. We have, it's, you know, not, it doesn't happen in every AO, but we've done things like this before, and I'll, you know, ask the council to back me up or tell me if I'm wrong about that, but I think we have done employee procedures like this in the past when it was the only way to get four votes for an answer. And this is really an attempt to try and accommodate everybody's concerns and actually answer the board requester's question. Am I wrong, Mr. General Counsel?
An appeal is being sought to our General Counsel. Mr. General Counsel.
Well, we've handled this kind of thing a number of different ways. We, as you know, we've had sometimes really stripped down advisory opinions that don't provide a lot of explanation or sometimes none.
This is looking better and better at this juncture, perhaps.
Yes.
I suppose.
No.
Right. And commissioners have written statements of reasons to explain their own grounds for joining in the conclusion. I have no doubt that there have been any number of advisory opinions where all commissioners don't share all conclusions or agree that all the facts asserted are important, but still join the opinion. And sometimes, as Commissioner Von Spakovsky said, we'll write separately to emphasize that a point was important or unimportant. I'm not aware, and Ms. Smith, whose recollection goes back longer than mine, isn't aware of a circumstance where the commission has addressed this kind of tried to break this impasse this particular way, although I'm personally not, I wouldn't think it's something we ought to do as a habit, but I'm not personally very troubled by a footnote that makes explicit what is often implicit or at least discussed at the meeting, which is that with respect to a particular fact that is presented, it is either important or unimportant to some commissioners. In this case, saying that some commissioners don't deem it a relevant factor, I think this one way of solving the problem again, I don't think the commission ought to do as a matter of habit, but I don't think it's particularly problematic either.
Vice Chairman Lenhardt.
Thank you. While I don't think the language is ideal, it is, in fact, I think my language is preferable.
That's why you offered it, right?
Exactly.
Well
crafted. But it, right, you're right. It did lose. And this is offered as a compromise. And were it to be adopted, I could vote in favor of the staff draft. If it is not, I can't. And so I guess, you know, when it comes to a vote, I will vote in favor of the compromise language.
It's one of the more succinct discussions of the points that we've had here this morning. Further discussion on the motion, and I think from my vantage point, the problem I'm struggling with is, and I understand that we sometimes read the regulations differently, I just don't see the presence or absence of these elements as relevant in the large number of circumstances, specifically any ads that are running more than 90 days before the election and any advertisements that are not targeted to the relevant electorate. As I read the regulations, the PSAs can proceed regardless of their subject matter under those circumstances, and that could, in fact, be the vast majority of the circumstances, depending upon when the PSAs air. So that's what I'm struggling with, but I recognize that we're taking an extended amount of time here to try to reach an accommodation. What I'm struggling with is I just don't see, as I read the regulations, these factors as being relevant. Further discussion on the Commissioner Weintraub's motion. Hearing none, I'll call the question. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed, say no.
Aye.
No.
I'm sorry.
Nay. Motion fails by a vote of 3-2. Commissioners Mason and Weintraub and the Vice Chairman voting affirmatively. Commissioners Toner and Von Spakovsky voting no. Do we want to have a motion on the staff draft? Commissioner Von Spakovsky.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move that we adopt the OGC draft as presented to us, which is agenda document number 06-47, without any changes.
Commissioner Von Spakovsky has moved adoption of agenda document number 0647, unamended. Discussion on Commissioner Von Spakovsky's motion. Hearing none, I'll call the question. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed?
No.
Motion fails by a vote of 3-2. Commissioners Toner, Mason, and Von Sikorski voting affirmatively. The Vice Chairman, Commissioner Weintraub, voting no. Mr. General Counsel, or Ms. Smith, or Ms. Knopf, are we in a circumstance where we have standard language indicating the Commission was unable to reach consensus in this matter?
Yes, we do.
Do you recommend that we implement that language on tally and approve based on that circumstance? Mr. General Counsel.
We could certainly do that. I don't know how much additional time exists and whether we would be able to get any additional time, but there is the possibility, given the closeness of some of these votes, that the vote of the absent commissioner could make a difference.
Are we up against the 60-day clock on this, Mr. General Counsel?
We have one more day, so we would need an extension. I guess that counts as up against the clock.
Just snuck it under the wire.
Yeah, how about those facts?
Well, I see the counsel for the requester has graced us with her presence here this morning, but I'd be amenable, if my colleagues are amenable and the requester are amenable, to seek additional time to see Commissioner Walther's pleasure on this matter. And if we're able to reach consensus, we could do that on tally, could we not?
We could certainly pursue that right after the meeting.
Okay. So I guess can council plan to meet with the requester on whether they're amenable to that, and we can see if we're able to reach consensus on that basis. Is there any further discussion on this matter? Okay. Thank you, Mr. Knopf. Our final item of business today is Advisory Opinion 2006-14, brought to us by the National Restaurant Association, and we have a late-submitted document. Mr. Vice Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would like to move for the suspension of the rules for the timely submission of documents to consider Agenda Document 06-44.
Vice Chairman, so moved. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion carries by a vote of 5-0 with Commissioner Walther present. And we have Brad Deutsch, Richard Yule, and Amy Rothstein on this matter. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning, Commissioners. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Agenda document number 06-44 consists of three alternative draft responses to a request for an advisory opinion from the National Restaurant Association's PAC. Through counsel, NRA PAC asks first whether it may communicate with the general public to expressly advocate the election or defeat of and solicit contributions to certain clearly identified candidates for federal office. NRA PAC also asks whether it may solicit the general public to send earmarked contributions to NRA PAC, which NRA PAC would then forward on to the designated candidates. All three drafts answer yes to the first question. The drafts conclude that NRA PAC may pay for and treat as independent expenditures the cost of its express advocacy communications to the general public, and that NRA PAC may solicit the general public to send contributions directly to federal candidates, so long as the communications are funded by voluntary contributions to NRA PAC and do not solicit contributions to any separate segregated fund. The three drafts differ, however, on whether NRA PAC may solicit the general public to send earmarked contributions to NRA PAC for NRA PAC then to forward on to the designated candidates. Draft A concludes that NRA PAC may not do so. Draft B concludes that NRA PAC may do so, but NRA PAC's costs to solicit, process, and transmit the earmarked contributions must be treated as in-kind contributions from NRA PAC to the designated candidates. Draft C also concludes that NRA PAC may do so, and the NRA PAC solicitation, processing, and transmittal costs could be treated as independent expenditures rather than as in-kind contributions. We have received three public comments on the drafts. We'd be happy to discuss them with you and to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you. I think the Commission has set a record for the number of drafts for a particular advisory opinion, but we wanted to ensure a lively discussion this morning, which I think we've achieved. A discussion of the drafts before us.
That was the one where we had
one draft.
Wow, this is perhaps a first here this morning. Any discussion of the competing approaches here before us? Commissioner Mason, thank you for stepping to the plate.
I'm actually prepared to move approval of draft C, but simply note that as to the issue of the solicitation costs was settled, I think, in the We Lead advisory opinion, where we overturned prior AO treating. In essence, the basis that was being used before was that the acceptance of the contributions by the campaign constituted their acceptance of the solicitation costs as an in-kind contribution, and I think that was based on an advisory opinion issued to NCPAC many years ago. And that appears to have been the only basis for the ENJ language, which is cited, I think, in draft B, in terms of the treatment. So having overturned that vis-a-vis We Lead, I didn't see how we could sustain it as to NRA and so, or to any other organization. And so I thought draft C had produced the correct reading of the law. I know, and my colleagues may want to discuss their view of how the restrictions on separate segregated funds bear on this. In my view, the SSF restrictions have to do with how the connected organization spends its non-PAC funds and don't have to do with how the SSF itself can spend its hard money. That is the voluntary contributions of the employees, stockholders, members, whoever it is who's allowed to contribute. And in that respect, I don't see how an SSF differs from any other political committee. That is, what's legal for any other political committee to do with their hard money is legal for an SSF to do with hard money. And so the solicitation restrictions and other restrictions that apply both because and only to the extent that corporate funds or union funds, connected organization funds, are being used to pursue those activities. And since that is the basis and the rationale of the restriction, I think that's as far as the restriction ought to go.
Thank you, Commissioner Mason. Additional discussion? Vice Chairman Linhorn.
My sense of the problem is somewhat different. For me, I find it enormously important that the entities involved and where they sit within the regulatory regime covers both corporations and unions, which are prohibited by statute from making contributions to candidates. There is an exception from that prohibition that gives them the capacity to create separate segregated funds or in the parlance of the street PACs, that they are actually given the ability to subsidize those PACs or SSFs, at least to the degree that they can bear the administrative and some of the solicitation costs of those entities. The trade for that is that they are only able to solicit from their restricted class a term of art that covers senior executive and in the context of labor organizations members of these entities, as well as there's a lot of detail as to who sits within the restricted class, but that there's a trade that they have the ability to subsidize the operations of these political committees and that they are restricted as to who they can solicit from. The draft C steps away from that regime in a couple of ways, both by allowing them to solicit beyond the class using separate segregated fund monies, hard money, but also allowing them to collect, process, and forward to the candidates the consequences or the contributions that flow from those solicitations. one of the things that concerns me is that the effect of that at the end of the day is that corporations and unions, to the degree that their solicitations are successful, will be able to deliver directly to politicians contributions of sums far in excess of what the separate segregated fund could contribute. Our regulations permit that presently in the very limited context of solicitations from members of the restricted class, but that this draft C of the advisory opinions would expand that capacity to the general public as well. And as a consequence, my sense is that it does not sufficiently track the statutory and regulatory regime that we have in place now. I think that and I've shared a little bit with Commissioner Mason, some of the other commissioners. I think that there is a logic to their approach. I think that it is that they draw well upon on the regulations and the AO in their analysis. But at the end of the day, I just don't share it.
Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I agree with the Vice Chairman on this. We could get into a very weedy argument about the provisions of 11 CFR 114. It would be a very exciting discussion, no doubt, but I think this is really a big picture issue. It's one of those, if we were to do that, we would be missing the forest for the trees. There's a reason why no SSF has ever done this before, and why this SSF, and I applaud the cleverness of counsel for SSF in thinking of this. It's a clever idea, but there's a reason why nobody ever asked this question before or thought they could do it before, because it was just sort of inherent in the structure of SSFs. They get to have their operations subsidized to some degree by their connected organization, corporations, labor unions, trade associations, to a degree that, in a way that other political committees don't get that kind of subsidy. And as a result, they can use all of their hard money for contributions. The SSFs can, whereas other non-connected committees have to spend some of the money that they collect paying their salaries and their overhead and all that stuff. But the trade-off is that SSFs can only solicit from a restricted class. And if we were to now say, oh, we've got all these rules, we've got this whole regulatory framework for solicitable class, for the solicitable class and how and when and who you can solicit, but you can also solicit everybody else. That's just sort of a surprising conclusion to me, and I think it would undermine and sort of make the rest of the regulations not make a lot of sense. Less because of any detailed analysis of Section 114 and more because I think all of those restrictions wouldn't make a lot of sense anymore if we were to vote for this. I can't support Draft C. Thanks.
Commissioner Von Spakovsky.
I think I heard you say, Commissioner Weintraub, that this would be something new, but I believe in Advisory Opinion 2003-23, We Lead, the Commission approved a similar proposal by We Lead, an SSF, to treat all costs associated with We Lead's solicitation of earmarked contributions from the general public as independent expenditures, as long as solicitations were not coordinated with any of the federal candidates. Didn't you vote to approve that previous advisory opinion?
I did, but it's not an SSF. It's a non-connected committee. And that is an enormous difference in my mind. And as I said earlier today, I judge every single one of these AOs based on the very specific facts that are in front of us. To me, that's the whole difference. A non-connected committee is not in any way subsidized by a corporation or labor union, and an SSF is. That's the difference.
A couple points from my part. First of all, I think it is absolutely true that the law is very clear that SSFs can only solicit from their restricted class, but that's when they're soliciting on behalf of the SSF. I think the law is very clear on that. I don't think the same prohibition exists for other activities for federal candidates as opposed to fundraising for the SSF. My first frame of reference is I come at this opinion from that vantage point. The other is that there's no question that SSFs are permitted under federal law to have their connected organizations subsidize their fundraising and overhead administrative costs, whereas non-connecteds do not have a connected organization to do that. But what I thought was important about the request before us today is that the requesters made clear that the connected organization was not in any way going to subsidize the activities at issue here today. That instead, all those activities would be funded 100% out of PAC dollars, out of hard dollars, which I thought was an appropriate reading of the law and an important safeguard, because it then makes clear that no general treasury funds of the connected organization would in any way be underwriting the activities at issue here, but instead would be covered 100% by PAC dollars. So the subsidization argument in terms of the distinction between connected and non-connected PACs is true as a legal matter, but I don't see it as in play here because of that safeguard. The other thing that I think is important is that and we got some comments along these lines, is that, you know, We Lead was an important development in the law, I think, in terms of removing artificial barriers to PAC activities that necessarily are hard dollar activities. And I think one of the most important aspects of that opinion was making clear that when fundraising for candidates is done independently of those candidates, that the solicitation costs can be treated as is not allocable to the recipient candidates. We had some, I think, some really good language in the We Lead opinion making clear that on that point we were overruling advisory opinion 1980-46, which took a different view, which essentially said that any monies that were accepted by a federal candidate constructively meant that the activities had to be treated as an in-kind contribution to the candidates. And I thought We Lead was an important development in the law by turning away from that approach, because that essentially hamstrings PACs from attempting to raise funds for like-minded candidates. And I thought this was a good opportunity for the commission to follow that concept and apply it to a connected PAC as well as a non-connected PAC. But I guess overall, in terms of my support for Draft C, it was mainly based on the fact that all the activities at issue are going to be covered by the PAC. There would be no subsidization by the connected organization in terms of the proposed activities, and that the We Lead opinion provided, I think, an important pathway for PACs to have broader ability to raise, help raise money for like-minded candidates, and that, in broad brush, was a good thing, was something to encourage, and was consistent with the emphasis in the McCain-Feingold law on hard dollar activities. But I concede that there's a lot of elements at the table here and a lot of difficult parts of our statute and our regulations, but I did think Draft C was an appropriate approach to this and would have been an important advancement in the law if it were adopted by the commission. Additional discussion on the issues? Do we want to entertain any motions? Do we want to go bowling? I apologize for our audience. That's an inside joke, but one that I can certainly emphasize that we're all looking forward to. Additional discussion or motions that we want to entertain here? Commissioner Mason and then the Vice Chairman. Commissioner Mason. Commissioner Mason.
I'm prepared to make a motion.
I was just indicating that you were indicating that you
were I move approval of Draft C of Draft Advisory Opinion 2006-14.
Commissioner Mason has moved approval of Draft C of Advisory Opinion 2006-14 that's before us here today. Discussion on Commissioner Mason's motion to adopt Draft C. Hearing none, I'll call the question. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed?
No.
Motion fails by a vote of 3-2. Commissioners Toner, Mason, and Bonsikowski voting affirmatively. The Vice Chairman, Commissioner Weintraub, voting no. Further motions that the Commission wishes to entertain for Advisory Opinion 2006-14? Well, Counsel, this is becoming a pattern here. Do we have standard language that perhaps we could provide to the requester in terms of our lack of consensus?
We do, Mr. Chairman.
Do you recommend that we approve that on tally to deal with this matter? Is that an option that's available? Commissioner Mason.
It's my recollection, and Rosie, please correct me if I'm wrong, that that actually hasn't been done by commission vote, but rather simply by a letter informing the requester of the commission's inability, and that would save us having to circulate something on tally.
You recommend proceeding in that fashion?
That's how we do it.
Okay. Then we can go ahead and do that. Is there any further discussion on the advisory opinion before us?